Welcome to Risking Enchantment, a podcast about art, beauty, and the Catholic faith, hosted by Rachel Sherlock.
Hello and welcome to Risking Enchantment. For this week's episode, you've got myself, Rachel Sherlock, and joining me is Phoebe Watson.
Hello!
It's good to have you back on the podcast, Phoebe.
Always good to be back.
And I hope our listeners are having a good Lent. It is flying. We were talking to a friend of ours recently who was saying at Mass, their priest was giving the sermon and saying, oh, well, Lent always drags on and it's always so long and slow. And both of us were agreeing that actually this Lent feels like it's gone very quickly.
Yeah, the lady in the shop today put it perfectly when she said, it feels like I haven't celebrated New Year yet.
Yes. But here we are in Ireland. As we're recording this, we're just getting ready for St. Patrick's Day. I hope this episode will go up sometime around Holy Week. But it's hard to believe that Lent will be over pretty much by the time I put this up. I expect it will be slightly later than my normal schedule because, and this will tie in with the topic that we're going to be discussing today, I am heading off to visit my friends in England. And my godson, I'm going to be spending a week with them, which I'm very much looking forward to. And they have been mentioned many times on this podcast. They are my friends who live in the Lake District of England, in Cumbria. And the Lake District is very famous in English literature. It's where Wordsworth was writing all of his great poetry. It's where Beatrix Potter was based and wrote her stories. But for this episode, we wanted to talk about another set of stories that are based in the Lake District, or at least the first couple are kind of set the tone for them and they're set in the Lake District, and that is the series of books of Swallows and Amazons.
Yep. They're such good books.
They're really good. And interestingly enough, my friends who I'm about to go visit had not read them despite having grown up and had lived...
Shocking. How did they do that?
Pretty much all their lives in the Lake District. But they have started reading them to their son, my godson. And so we're all a little bit Swallows and Amazons crazy at the moment. We're all loving it deeply.
Yep.
And so it feels like a really appropriate time to talk about them. I also regret to say that I did not get to enjoy these books as a kid. I didn't come across them. I don't know why. But I have read just the first two of them in the last, in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I would have read the first one as a like slightly older preteen, mm-hmm. I guess. Kind of hard to place when, you know? And then the fourth one. They're not the kind of books that you have to read them all sequentially. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't read any others until you got back into them 2 years ago. And funnily enough, my sister-in-law is also really into them. Mm. So she was able to lend me some of them as well just recently. So I've read about, I think, 5 or 6 of the total 10.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them in the series. And so we're going to give a little bit of a plot summary, I guess, especially for the first one and on into the second one. But the series as a whole follows a group of children. There's 2 to 3 families as the series goes on. It starts with 2 main ones. There's the Walkers, who are probably the real central characters of the stories. And they include the eldest, John, the eldest daughter Susan, and then it's Titty, and then Roger, and I don't know whether baby Bridget ever actually gets to feature properly in the stories, but she is in the background.
She's never featured in any of the ones that I've read. She's also confusingly called Victoria in the first book
because she looks like Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's about them going to the Lake District for their holidays, and they are out in nature, in the wild, camping and having adventures and going on all kinds of interesting nature explorations and all of these things. And they meet the Blackets, who are, well, they give themselves pirate names. I think their names are Ruth and Margaret, but they go by Nancy and Peggy because they feel like more pirate names. And both of these families have their own little sailing boats that they sail around the lakes of the Lake District. And so sailing is a huge part of these books. In fact, it's one of the kind of defining parts of these books. Is there are lots of stories of kids out on bikes, but these are kids out in boats.
Yeah, and they're always out on their own most of the time as well. It's very similar to the famous five in that way, that it's the kids out without the parents. But the parents and some of the adults do also come into it in a more interesting way, and we're going to talk about that a little bit as well. But yeah, they end up camping on this island and having just all these adventures of that are partly tied to their own imagination of the place. Like, they're going out as explorers and imagining that they're exploring the island that has they've never that nobody has ever been to before.
Yeah.
So there's always that level of imagination, but most of them are still very firmly grounded in the real world, at least for the first few.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not a series that of absolutely unimaginable adventures.
Yeah, there's very much two layers going on. And I was going to say, yeah, what I really love about these books is that I just feel like there's such a deep sense of decency and goodness in these books. They're sort of at least some background characters who are antagonistic in some ways. There's in the second book, there's the great aunt who stops Nancy and Peggy from going out and having fun.
In the first book, there's a big misunderstanding between them and one of the adults.
Yeah, but there's just such a wonderful sense of decency in these books. There's that it's a setting full of characters who are not sort of cardboard cutout good characters. They're actually the kids are so rounded, and all the characters are really rounded, that they have personalities and they have failings and they have skills and they have all of these things, but they're just extremely decent and good. And it's very, I don't know, when I read it, it's very reassuring about the goodness of humanity.
Yeah, and there's a really wholesome sense of the community around this lake as mm-hmm. well.
Which is then forms like, yeah, you have these this sense of wholesome community on this backdrop, which is so beautiful. And if anyone has been to the Lake District, I just think it's one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Oh, it's stunning.
Yeah. And, you know, we might actually say a little bit, which is that a group of my friends from Dublin here, we all piled into a car last September to drive across the Lake District to see these friends of mine. And that was its own adventure. And it's so wonderful to get to share that landscape with other people. I just love it so much. But that'll come into it because we're going to be talking about the sense of adventure. But I just love this incredible backdrop that he renders, not in like huge amounts of detail, but just very deftly with like a lot of lovely imagery, places them in the Lake District. But as you were saying, then there's almost like a film that comes down on top of that beautiful landscape, which is the imaginative layer that the kids put on top of what's really there, in the way that they rename a lot of the places so that they sound like something out exotic out of the storybooks that they were reading, or their father in the book is in the Navy, and so he is presumably writing home about all of these exotic places, and they're hearing about all of these far-flung locations, and they're sort of placing that on top of what is actually there. So not only do you have them camping on an island, but at times it's Robinson Crusoe's island. You know, it's not just an island, it's an island that has a story of its own to them. Or in the second one, they want to climb the Old Man of Coniston, which is already a very whimsical name. I gotta say, the Lake District,
it's a good name.
Doesn't need to have extra imagination put onto it to make it seem like something out of a storybook, but they call it Kanchenjunga, which is a Himalayan mountain. And
or in the first one, they're drawing up their map of the area, mm-hmm. and they're even like, oh, we have to get it done before Nancy and Peggy come, mm-hmm. because they'll have all their own names for stuff,
mm-hmm.
and we need to have our names for things.
Yeah, exactly. And so they have this real sense of imagination, and so you're always kind of getting both what's really happening and then their imagination version of it as well. But as you were saying, Phoebe, that never takes away from the fact that they are actually physically, practically inhabiting their space. It's so interesting to me how Arthur Ransom, who wrote the books, was able to get such practical details in without it feeling like a textbook. Like
you read a lot of other books that try and layer in the practical details, mm-hmm. and you're just like, oh, this just feels so burdensome.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, and there's a wonderful article in the Slightly Foxed Journal, which you can find actually on their index and their online version. Slightly Foxed, if anyone doesn't know, is a journal that I really love. It's sort of spotlights lesser known books. But one of the articles was about Swallows and Amazons, and the writer Jim Ring says, Yet another is the passion for practicalities. Read the books and you'll find out precisely how to pitch tents, find sources of clean water, create pools in which to wash and wash up, build fireplaces, make pigeon ring bells, construct blast furnaces, and above all, learn how to sail. I know many people whose enthusiasm for and knowledge of sailing is entirely derived from these books.
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a testament to something that doesn't, like you said, doesn't feel cumbersome or burdensome on the story. It's actually part of the thrill of reading it because you get a real sense of these kids really doing these things.
Yeah, it's more like just a layering in of that context that is told in a way that expects you to already know what these are, which I think is part of the joy of it as well.
Yeah.
I really want to learn how to tie good knots because of this book.
And I think maybe that's where we're going to start into our topic proper, which is that we wanted to talk about the sense of adventure in the books and how that is realized through the practical ways that the children have learned skills and are given the freedom to go out and have adventures. And before we start into this properly, like, we did want to say, for those listeners who have children and are making decisions about how much freedom their kids should have or like how they should be allowing their kids to live, we don't have kids. This is not going to at all be parental advice. We don't have anything to offer in that realm.
We're not telling you that you need to send your four kids out to camp alone on an island in the Lake District.
Right. We're saying, I think you, maybe. No, what we're saying is that that it is important to cultivate adventure in whatever form that that takes in your life and if you're a parent in the lives of your children. And it, this can be just as applicable to adults. So like I said, when we were bumming across to the Lake District in our car, that was an adventure to me. Mm-hmm. That was outside of my comfort zone. We were getting up very, I don't know, late at night or early
getting
in the morning.
Getting up doesn't really count. Did we go to bed?
To drive across. Like, it, to me, that was an adventure. Yeah. And so it is totally relevant to anyone at any stage of life, but I do think we associate it with childhood, and so it's good to look at it through the lens of childhood and then to apply it to what that might look like for an adult. But you know, I will say that both Phoebe and I, in surprisingly different ways, but we both had childhoods where at least at some times we were free to roam around the countryside.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think I've said this before, but my mum was always really insistent that we would have adventures. I found out afterwards we were always left to go like explore the woods and go up the fields and even down to the river beside our house. And it was only when I was much older that I asked my mum, did you like that we just wandered off? And she was like, no, I'd have much preferred if you'd stayed in the garden and I could have kept an eye on you. But she said that you needed to have adventures. And it wasn't about what I felt super comfortable with. It was the fact that I know you needed to go off and have space on your own as kids to navigate these things and figure them out. And it's really complicated to know how to implement that, especially in this modern day. But at least I think we can agree that it is a good thing when we can do it and allow our children to do it. And that's why these books are so wonderful, because they present such an offering of what that can look like. And obviously, real life doesn't look like storybooks all that often.
I've just put something together.
Yeah.
So my sister loved exploring. Uh-huh. And she was the one who got given Swallows and Amazons and loved it first. And we used to go off exploring.
Yeah.
And that must have come from this book. I had never put that together before.
Right. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's such a lovely thing. And I think why that it's important and why we wanted to talk about this topic is that I do think it actually genuinely relates to the Christian life, both on just a direct level, that I think it is good for our souls to push ourselves out to go on adventures and to experience the world and be out in creation, like just on that very like plain one-to-one comparison, but also that there's another level in which there is a great adventure, the adventure of our lives that we're called to be in, and that having this mentality of adventure allows us to enter into that. And of course, I mean, there's some famous Pope Benedict the 16th quotes on this, although there's one or two that get a little bit mistranslated. So I think I've got the original ones here. But he says, "What does the Lord want of me? Of course, this is always a great adventure, but life can be successful only if we have the courage to be adventurous, trusting that the Lord will never leave me alone, that the Lord will go with me and help me." And then he says in Spe Salvi, "Man was created for greatness, for God himself. He was created to be filled by God, but his heart is too small for the greatness to which it is destined. It must be stretched."
They're so good. I think it's so true that there's something about being put out of your comfort zone in an adventure sense that really helps you to learn your limits and learn that they're not maybe not what you thought they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also to put virtues to their testing points.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you really learn, and that's where you gain skills, you know, the kind of sink or swim moment that mm-hmm. you really have to actually, if you're always just staying in the shallow end, are you really going to learn how to swim?
Like Roger always trying to keep one foot on the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. And it's only when we push ourselves to go further that we actually find out what we're capable of. And I think that word capable is so important for me in terms of these books, which is that the kids just have great capabilities. They can make fires and they can sail boats, and it's not beyond them to learn these things. And that's not just fictionalized, that it is true that we can actually, even well, you know, as you get older, you can still learn new things and become more capable. And what a gift that is to have the capacity to master more things. That's a great gift from God that allows us to go on to do greater and greater things.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful also that these are skills that they've learned from their parents, from especially with the two older kids, from being on adventures with their parents, and now having the opportunity to go out alone and teach those skills to their younger siblings.
Yeah, and I think especially in terms of like minding their younger siblings and then also bringing them along and raising them up in their skills and like helping them to learn, it really drives home to me what I really struck me about the books, which is the way that it conveys how, in terms of adventures, you're working towards gaining some kind of freedom. Like the kids in Swallows and Amazons have the freedom to go live on this little island by themselves for the summer. And at the same time, the reason they can do that is because they have been responsible in learning the skills needed to do that. And they have the kind of moral strength to follow through on that continually. Their mother and their father, who writes home and says that they can do it, they know that they can trust their kids to follow through on all of the practicalities and all of the things that they have to do. It's not, the adventure is not just about a free-for-all of doing whatever I want to do and having no rules and being absolutely free to do anything. There's a little bit of that, of finding your own way, but at the same time, there's a sense of responsibility as well.
Yeah, like there's this beautiful quote about the older sister, Susan. It's in the second book, but it says, "When the washing up was all done and the bundles of dry sticks carried up out of the forest to the campfire, which Susan had already coaxed into life again, there were soon leaping flames about the kettle. That was Susan's strong point. She never allowed excitements such as sleeping in the open halfway up a mountain, or naval battle, or a dangerous bit of exploring, to interfere with the things that really matter. Such as seeing that the water is really boiling before making tea with it, having breakfast at the proper time, washing as usual, and drying anything that may be damp. Really, if it had not been for Susan, half the Swallows' adventures would have been impossible. But with a mate as good as that, to see that everything went as it should, there was no need for any native to worry about what was happening." For context, it's Captain John, Mate Susan, Able Seaman Titty, Ship's Boy Roger.
Yeah, they've given themselves all of the naval titles. And also, natives almost always refers to adults.
Or their parents.
Yeah.
Like their mother is often referred to as the best of natives.
as the group of people other than the explorers. Yeah, I love that because it really shows how much it goes into actually allowing yourselves to go do things like that, that like it requires having, you know, responsibility to follow up on all of the mundane tasks that allow you to then go do these greater things.
And being willing to be, in a way, a little bit of the killjoy.
Mm.
That she's not afraid of her crew, like, grumbling about it.
Yeah.
That, oh, Susan's making us do this now.
Yeah.
That they see the value in what she's doing.
Yeah.
And she knows how important it is.
Mm.
Just before that quote comes one of my favourite quotes about her, which says that she was in her most native mood when she's making them tidy up the camp, etc. But yeah, there's that sense of one person being responsible, but them all sharing in that responsibility as well.
Yeah. And they're all... they all have their various responsibilities. Like John is the Captain John is responsible for most of the sailing and getting them there safely and being in charge of things like compasses and maps and these kinds of elements. And I will say, for an old story, it was written in the kind of early part of the 20th century. It's also not just that the girl does all of the cooking and the boys do all of the exploring. There is genuinely a sense of roundedness to all of their characters. And the Blacketts, Nancy and Peggy, they're just like whirlwind dervishes and they're not even interested in exploring. They want to have naval battles all the time. And
They're the pirates.
Yeah, it's so great. So it's wonderful to have these books that actually feel like they're encouraging kids in all kinds of areas.
Yeah, and encouraging kids to group together and enjoy doing these things. That there's no like, oh, the boys go off and do this bit and the girls separate out and do this bit.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the other element that, in terms of the responsibility that really strikes me, is that they're not only just capable and responsible in the practicalities that they're doing, but they have a strong sense of the moral rectitude of like what's expected of them and how they should relate and what they owe to their mother, who is a wonderful character in the books, but that like their mother can rely on them to tell the truth and to be honest when things have gone wrong and to check in with her as she asks, you know, that like she doesn't have to worry about whether they're hiding anything from her or whether they're doing things that she's asked them not to do.
Yeah, like there's this beautiful scene where in the first book they've been sailing at night and they've almost crashed and John's kind of, they've had a rethink about this and being like, oh, we pushed that too far, we shouldn't have done this. And John makes the decision to go and tell his mother about it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't wait until the end of the holiday. He goes that day and fesses up to it, I guess you'd say, with the full knowledge that she might, you know, decide that maybe they shouldn't sail anymore for the holiday. Or
yeah,
there's a number of things she might you might say sensibly do about that. But rather, he makes a promise to her to not do that again and that they won't go night sailing again. And that comes in later, where it's in the fourth book, which is called Winter Holiday, where the lake is all frozen over. It's beautiful. But there's a case of them going out skating at night, and they decide at some point that that's too close to night sailing and that that would be breaking the equivalent promise, which is that not just being held to a promise, but being held to the spirit of the promise and not the wording of it.
Mm-hmm.
That they're able to take other situations and judge them accordingly.
Yeah.
Which I think is really part of this moral character that they have.
Yeah. And I think it's almost like a beautiful way to have, at least in a small way, a comparison to our relationship with God. That I think there's a lot of stories where like the adults are completely absent. And there's reasons for that, because you want the child protagonist to have the freedom to go off and have adventures. That's
what child doesn't pretend to be an orphan so they can pretend to have adventures.
Right, exactly. But I think in Swallows and Amazons, there's actually a beautiful element where that's not quite the case. They are integrated with their family. The dad is away in the Navy, but the mother is actually present and they like spending time with her, and it's a good thing. And actually, when they first see the island, their first suggestion is actually that all of the family goes, the mother and their baby sister come along, and that's just not practical. Yeah. So they can't,
but that's what they're asking for originally.
Yeah.
And that in itself would have been a joy and delight.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to just read that little section, just because I think it's so beautiful in terms of setting up the spirit of wonder and adventure in the story. It says, "And on the lake they had seen the island. All four of them had been filled at once with the same idea. It was not just an island. It was the island waiting for them. It was their island. With an island like that within sight, who could be content to live on the mainland and sleep in a bed at night? They had gone back and told their mother of their discovery and begged that the whole family should leave the farmhouse the next day and camp on the island forever."
The conclusion of that is great.
But a bit like what I was saying about my own mother, that Mrs. Walker has this real sense that actually they, not only she couldn't come to the island because of the baby, but that there is something good in them going off by themselves. And in fact, she says, when she sort of drops them off at the island and has a kind of final farewell, she says, "I'm not going to be coming in and checking on you all the time." And John says, "You don't bother us, Mother," you know, that like she's not pushing her away. And she says, "In any case, I won't be coming in to check on you, but can you please write me letters every 2 to 3 days? Can you drop into the house every once in a while?" You know, that like she is interested. She is, and we will see even further, she enters into their imagination and their games. She plays along with the languages that they make up. She calls them by the names that they're giving themselves. You know, that she'll call, when she meets the Blackett, she'll call them Nancy and Peggy rather than their real names. That like that willingness to enter into what's important to them and their imagination, and not to put herself above all of those sort of like childish trivialities, that she's really engaged and interested, and that their spirit of adventure comes from her as well. It's not just their father that's in the Navy. She's been out sailing her whole life. This is a whole family perspective on things. And yet she knows that on some level they need their own space to do these things by themselves.
Yeah, like there's a time where Titty greets her as, "Hello, Man Friday." And she responds with, "Hello, Robinson Crusoe," said Mother. "That was the best of Mother. She was different from other natives. You could always count on her to know things like that." Robinson Crusoe and Man Friday then kissed each other as if they were pretending to be Titty and Mother.
Yeah, that like she's just so ready to enter into that spirit with them of all of the games and fun that they're having, and yet at the same time give them the space to do it themselves as well. Mm-hmm. And as will come up in the books, that like when they make mistakes, and like you said with John, and like there's some particularly notable bits in the second book as well, that like they have to admit that things have gone wrong to her, and she is of course concerned and of course interested and wants to check up on them. But there isn't that sense of, once she's heard what's happened and that they have been as responsible as they could have been once things went wrong, that it isn't about reprimanding, it isn't about shouting, it isn't about cutting off all of their privileges, but just about checking in with them again and seeing, well, what can they do now, and like what would be responsible for them to do now, and not just putting a lockdown on the whole thing and saying, "No more, you have to all come home now."
And very often going in the background to arrange things, mm-hmm. like setting up where they can get the milk from the farm and sending somebody round with supplies for them.
Yeah.
She's putting in a lot of work for them, mm-hmm. but not trying to control it as her own.
Yeah. And that's where I feel like it relates almost to God, in that it's not about coming cowering to him with the thing you did wrong and expecting to be struck down with lightning, but to have that sense of, I owe it to this person to come to them with the truth of what's been going on, to tell them what I've really been doing, but also to know that that love and support is there. And to know that, because they, like you said, John comes with the expectation, she could say, well, I think that's enough, you guys have to come home. Not in a mean way, but that like this situation won't really work now. And saying, well, having that sense of obedience of saying, I still owe it to her to tell her, even if it means that I'll get cut off from doing the things that I want to do. Or there is that sense of responsibility, obedience, love, safety. There's just a real beautiful relationship in that parental relationship in the book.
Yeah, fully agreed.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also worth talking a little bit about the other adults in the book as well, because I guess for us not being parents, it's still really inspiring to see how other adults can get really involved in their lives. And there's one character in particular, he goes by the name of Captain Flint, according to the children, and they're having a naval battle with him, where he's lighting his mock cannon on his houseboat, and they've overcome him and made him walk the plank. And after he's walked the plank and been allowed to come back onto the boat, he asks, what are you going to do with me now? You've captured my ship, you've hauled down my noble elephant flag, you've trussed me up like a chicken, you've made me walk the plank. I've walked it, dodged the sharks, and come aboard to report for duty. Do you think my crimes are wiped out? Because if they are, he paused. What? Said Captain Nancy. All the best sea fights end with a banquet, said Captain Flint. And there's one waiting in the cabin and nobody but the parrot to on guard there.
Yeah.
And I just love the whimsy of that, that he set up this whole thing knowing that he had done them wrong in a way, and this is his way of making up for it.
Mm-hmm.
But also not having gone down without a fight.
But like to know that they wanted the conflict, yeah. They wanted the drama, so that they had the whole adventure with him and walking the plank and all of these things. And so not just trying to fix it with them, but actually like allow them to have their sort of quote-unquote revenge in some way.
Yeah, though they probably would have thought themselves still well justified if he'd won and he'd made them all walk the plank too.
Yeah. I just love it so much, and I just think that these stories really show how when we cultivate the right attitude towards our responsibilities and our duties and our morals, that it actually gives us more freedom rather than less. That the children have more freedom in their lives because they have these strictures that they themselves obey and that they can follow, and that they know that they, both on practical levels of making sure that, you know, they wash their dishes and that they wash themselves and all of these things, and also that they can be responsible and that they can be trusted to go and have these independent adventures. And it gives them the freedom to do the small things that are important to them independently and make some of their own decisions.
Yeah.
I always think of my friend Kate often references whenever we're packing up food for a little picnic, there's one of the famous five stories, which I loved so much as a kid. They were real ones for me about sort of independence. Like you said, those were kids on bikes. Yeah. They would just head off on bikes and have adventures. And in this particular one, I think it's The Five Get Into Trouble is the name of the book. And of course has a wonderful description, just like Swallows and Amazons. I feel like kids' books have the best descriptions of food. But they have this big picnic with ice lollies and sandwiches and ginger beer, and they've kind of had it kind of early and they've all sat down for a nap. And it says, it was 3:30 when they all awoke one by one. Julian looked at his watch. It's almost tea time, he said, and Anne gave a little squeal. Oh no, why? We've only just had lunch and I'm still as full as can be. Julian grinned, and this is the bit that my friend Kate always quotes. It's all right. We'll go by our tummies for our meals, not by our watches, Anne. And it's just, you know, it's such a, I love that particular line struck her so forcefully. But she says that it's about that sense of being able to determine when you want to eat and to, you know, divvy up your food in the way that you want to divvy it up, and have that sense of adventure in that, even in those like small little ways, that when you follow these bigger forms of responsibility, that it gives you this license to go off and do these things yourself.
Yeah, and it's also that responsibility of them having charge of their own food for mm-hmm. the day and having to manage it in a way that they're not getting hungry.
Yeah, and then living with the consequences, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
We debated how much we're going to talk about the second book, just because there's kind of, I don't know if it's a spoiler, but there's a big plot point that happens near the start. But let's say they end up not being able to spend as much time on Wildcat Island as they expect from, you know, in the first book, they spend pretty much all of it on Wildcat Island. So they come back the next year with the expectations that things are going to be exactly the same. And they're not. And instead, they spend a lot of time in this place that they call Swallowdale, which is, you know, on the mainland, as it were. And it's a beautiful space, and they have water, and it's a lovely space. But for this particular place, it doesn't have firewood. And so the book goes through the practicalities of, like, we have to actually collect firewood and bring it back to this place. Like, it's not just a paradise where everything is offered up to them on a plate, that choices on where you camp and what you do have practical implications that mean hard work, that mean extra effort in a particular area, that to stay warm, they have to go and do this thing every day. This is an extra chore for them. And Titi says, and I have to leave out some of the words in this just to leave it a little bit enigmatic as to what happens in the book. But she's talking about how, with them being marooned, that it wouldn't be right if there weren't some hardships involved. And I love that perspective. Yeah.
We ought to have some hardship or it wouldn't be proper.
Exactly.
And it's also bringing it into that level of imagination that then becomes part of their story.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the idea of embracing hardship is really important for that kind of adventure mentality.
Yeah, and one of the really lovely things about that second book is it focuses on what you do when things don't go the way you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this scene where there's been a great disaster and nobody's recriminating anybody else. There's no tutting. There's no, like, oh, you did that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They know that the person at fault knows how much they're at fault already.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else is just getting on with it and making the best of it and chipping in how they can.
Yeah.
And it's a real example of, yeah, how to cope with disaster and how to cope with things going wrong in life.
Mm-hmm. And to readjust your expectations mm-hmm. and how to have a good time anyway.
Yeah. And yeah, there's this sense that there's also a level of discomfort that goes with these adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Like Titi saying about hardship or them being soaking wet and cold, that that we have to go out of our comfort zone, and that means being uncomfortable.
Yeah, right.
Like, those things actually equate. And I think particularly as adults, I find this in myself, of being trapped into an attachment to comfort
mm-hmm.
that can stop me from anticipating an adventure or enjoying an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's also this sense of which part of the joy of an adventure comes in the telling of it afterwards.
Mm.
Like, going back to the mother, we hear the mother telling stories of some of her adventures to the kids, and them retelling to her their adventures and making the real adventures into stories.
Yeah.
And that part of that telling stories about the adventure is what makes the adventure itself.
Right. And that in the telling of it, it's always the uncomfortable bits that actually in some ways both get dulled because you're not in that, you've come through that mm-hmm. horrible experience, and yet those are often the kind of interesting or funny or, you know, noteworthy bits. And I was thinking,
like us driving to the Lake District in the middle of the night and being exhausted,
right?
But that's part of what makes the adventure.
Yeah, it would have been so much less of an adventure to go at a nice respectable time
which we considered.
Yeah. And it reminded me of, I love that section in The Hobbit where he's been coaxed out on this adventure, nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things make you late for dinner, which is such a great description. And can I add that Tolkien was a fan of The Swallows and Amazons books, as I found out in Holly Ordway's book, Tolkien's Modern Reading. So just anyone who is a fan of either both of them or maybe Tolkien and you're getting interested in these books, they have a kinship there. But when he's describing that move that they have going from the lands of the Shire, where everything's kind of respectable, into the actual properly adventurous bit, which is outside Bilbo's comfort zone. So it says, "So after that, the party went along very merrily, and they told stories and sang songs as they rode forward all day, except, of course, when they stopped for meals. These didn't come quite as often as Bilbo would have liked them, but still he began to feel that adventures were not so bad after all. At first they had passed through Hobbit lands, a wide, respectable country inhabited by decent folk with good roads, an inn or two, and now and then a dwarf or a farmer ambling by on business. Then they came to lands where people spoke strangely and sang songs Bilbo had never heard before. Now they had gone far into the lone lands, where there were no people left, no inns, and the roads grew steadily worse. Not far ahead were dreary hills rising higher and higher, dark with trees. On some of them were old castles with an evil look, as if they had been built by wicked people. Everything seemed gloomy, for the weather that day had taken a nasty turn. Mostly it had been as good as May can be, even in merry tales. But now it was cold and wet. In the lone lands they had been obliged to camp when they could, but at least they had been dry. To think it will soon be June," grumbled Bilbo as he splashed along behind the others in a very muddy track. "It was after tea time, it was pouring with rain, and had been all day. His hood was dripping into his eyes, his cloak was full of water, the pony was tired and stumbled on stones. The others were too grumpy to talk. And I'm sure the rain has gotten into the dry clothes and into the food bag," thought Bilbo. "Bother burglaring and everything to do with it. I wish I was at home in my nice hole by the fire with the kettle just beginning to sing." It was not the last time that he wished that. And I love how that takes us from the like comfort zone version of adventures into the actually uncomfortable. But what strikes me about that is when you get to it from the perspective of the Lord of the Rings, which is that Bilbo's adventures are cast in this sort of very merry light, that like it's all good fun and who wouldn't want to be on Bilbo's adventures. And now don't get me wrong, I do think that the adventures of the Lord of the Rings have a different element. There is a much more sort of sinister threat to them. They are being pursued from behind, not just going towards something. But that Frodo is sort of idolizing Bilbo's adventures and thinking, like, I'd like to have a nice adventure like that. And then finds that when he's on an adventure, it's horrible and he doesn't like it. But it's so easy to forget that Bilbo was hating being on an adventure as well.
Yep.
So I love that sense that you do need to sit in that level of discomfort and be willing to experience it in order to go on to bigger and greater things in your life. But I think the flip side of it is that I also was really struck in reading these books how being on adventures or like putting yourself out into the world, like camping and doing those kinds of things, it also re-enchants the simple mundane things of life that you normally take for granted. So not only are you experiencing sort of greater things, you're climbing a mountain or you're going somewhere, you're exploring somewhere that you've never seen before, but you're also relishing the small things that you might otherwise overlook if you were just sitting at home with the very same things.
Yeah, like there's this delight in the nature around them, and one of them's forever stopping to look at a caterpillar or look at a butterfly and having to be called on. Mm-hmm. To, like, you have to keep going on the adventure as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that delight of the campfire and eating food outdoors, that there's like a real heartiness to what they're doing.
Yeah. And that, you know, it's that line that I said from when they're looking at the island where they say, who could sleep in a bed when there's an island to be slept on, you know? And that when they get to the island, they're in their tents and they're relishing being snuggly and warm, but they're sleeping on straw bags, whereas they could be at home on a mattress. That it does give an air of beauty and enchantment. And like I said, I love the descriptions of food, but they're things like apples, you know. Yeah. They're eggs and bread and, you know,
corned beef,
right? And but they just seem so much more magical. And that too also reminded me of Roald Dahl, because I think he's really good at drawing out some of those moments in his books as well. I was thinking of the bit in Matilda, and it always really strikes me when she goes to Miss Honey's house and it turns out she lives in this cottage which literally just sitting on upturned boxes, and she has like a little paraffin stove and she sleeps on the floor, and Miss Honey gives Matilda some food which is just bread and margarine. And it's so funny because Matilda sees margarine and she goes, "Margarine? She really must be poor." But it goes on to say that Matilda perched herself carefully on an upturned box, and more out of politeness than anything else, she took a slice of bread and margarine and started to eat it. At home, she would have been having buttered toast and strawberry jam, and probably a piece of sponge cake to round it off. And yet this was, somehow, far more fun. And isn't that just beautiful? And she says, there was a mystery here in this house, a great mystery. There was no doubt about that. And Matilda was longing to find out what it was. So the whole thing is like wrapped together. It's an unusual setting. It's something that she doesn't yet fully understand and she wants to explore. And it gives this like slice of bread and margarine an element of fun to it. Whereas, you know, if she'd had that at home, she'd have been like, ugh, why would I want this? I want my toast and jam.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it in terms of overcoming material comfort as well. There's that element of value, like trying to assess what you really need in life,
mm-hmm.
that she doesn't need to have buttered toast and jam if she's got bread and margarine and an adventure on the side.
And is in the company of somebody who loves her.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that you see that as well with the Swallows and Amazons when they're on adventures. Like, they're always making decisions about what they do or don't need.
Mm.
And having to simplify things that way.
Yeah.
But also then that being part of the magic, that this is what they have. These are their ship stores
mm-hmm.
to get them through.
Yeah, that having both that adventurous spirit and that imagination allows you to enter into the true gift. And like in some ways, the reality of what is really in front of us, like an apple is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
A mug of tea is a beautiful thing. And it's wonderful when we can approach these simple things in life with the spirit of wonder that is kind of due to them. But it's when we take them out of their normal context that we appreciate them more. And when we have less, when we're out of our comfort zone, when we're not buffered by all of our usual, you know, various blankets that we put around ourselves to make our days easier, that being out in these experiences helps us to really enter into the spirit of like a kind of sacramental worldview.
Yeah, of really treasuring what you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's times when they're all eating from a common pot and being willing to share in that and engage in that life.
Yeah. And I think it's a really good reminder of how important it is to engage in the natural world. I think you can have adventures in a whole bunch of different ways, and it can look different for adults than it can for kids. It can look different for if you're living, you know, you and I, Phoebe, have been living in a city for many years. We still get out to the countryside sometimes, but it's not like it's right on our doorstep anymore. And so it's not that there's only one type of way to have adventures, or that your life's adventure can only be if you're like super sporty and outdoorsy or something like that.
That you
like,
have to be wild camping for it to be an adventure.
Right. But that it is a good reminder that entering into the gift of creation and of the natural world, I think, is genuinely very fundamentally important for everyone, and to access it even in small ways when we can. Because I think the natural world challenges us to raise to those kinds of capabilities that I was talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
that it is where you're less buffered, and so that you actually have to learn how to do things physical with your hands or with your, like, whatever it is. And I think you made a really interesting point about how the kids have their version of themselves at school and have their version of themselves out in the wild.
Yeah, like there's this part at the start of Swallowdale where Titty's musing on the part of herself that was having so much trouble with French grammar, and saying that that felt almost like a different Titty to the one that's now the able seaman in The Swallow, and that there's that like sense of her capability and her joy in this that has gotten her through French grammar in school all year, and is now able to rejoice in being this person. And I think there's that for any kid, there's that sense of having an identity outside of school, which having these kind of adventures can be part of, that allows you to be more than just your school persona.
And that there's more than one type of way to be intelligent and capable and have talents. That, yeah, I think we can be very focused, especially with kids, on how they can deliver and perform for very academic or even institutional ways, like, because like I'm thinking even like dance and music lessons and things like that, which are all great, I love all of them, but that there are other ways of being knowledgeable and other ways of being capable, and that we should value both of them. And that if you're someone who struggles in and maybe in an academic setting or a social setting or, you know, a creative setting, that to make sure that there you also have the opportunity to explore this kind of self-expression as well.
Yeah, and I think that follows through into adulthood as well, that we need to be more than the sum of our parts, or more than just our jobs.
Right, and that there's the sort of the world of business. I always think of that that line in A Muppet Christmas Carol, "You will love business." But that, yeah, that we can be very focused on these sort of more commercial or more money earning, or like, that's not to say that there's plenty of jobs out in the world that earn money, whether it's farmers or fishermen or any of those kinds of things, but that it's very easy to become preoccupied with one way of knowing and being. And I think it really reminded me as well of that, how I just think that there is something fundamentally important for us to know and understand the created world around us, and that it is deeply important to our souls to have some kind of contact and knowledge with the natural world. And it was reminding me, I think I came across this first on one of Katie Marquette's episodes. I think it was on something about the digital age on the Born of Wonder podcast, but I came across the quote myself as well when I was doing some reading for this episode, which was talking about how in recent years, in the last couple of years, the Oxford Junior Dictionary has omitted a bunch of nature words, along with, interestingly, religious words as well, such as like bishop and saint and nun. But it's taken out some of these more natural words and replaced them with things like that, with words. And I do understand that they're trying to be practical and apply words that are relevant to children today. But I do think there is something almost more important about learning about nature, even if you're a young person who spends a lot of time on their phone. So they are replacing them with things like words like blog or cut and paste, or, you know, these, it makes me cringe. And I mean, I'm sure the kids need to know it, but I just think it's so much more important that they know their nature words. So I have the quote, "There is a list of nature words which have apparently been expunged from the Oxford Junior Dictionary to make room for new ones, and because they are, quote, no longer felt to be relevant to a modern day childhood." And then the person writing this article went on to say, "I wondered how many of these are mentioned in Arthur Ransom's novels. I haven't quite got the time to check on all of them. Most of the novels are set in the summer, so mentions of, say, bluebells aren't likely, nor do I recall mistletoe cropping up in Winter Holiday. But here are a few which definitely do occur. For example, adder, hazel, heather, heron, kingfisher, otter, pasture, willow. I think it's sad if fewer of today's children are reading Ransom, but if words like these aren't relevant, it rather suggests that there's a more serious issue. i.e. that other authors aren't filling the gap, helping to give children a rich and realistic, detailed acquaintance with the natural world.
Yeah, that's so sad, because there's something so beautiful about not just being out in nature, but being able to understand it and read it and navigate through it,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, what these books really highlight.
Yeah, absolutely. That I think, you know, as someone who runs a podcast, I would much rather kids know what blackberries and crocuses are than a podcast. But yeah, I think there is a wonder and a deep sense of the beauty of creation that we are missing if we ever think that these things aren't relevant to any childhood. I think they're relevant to all childhoods. And I think, you know, you can tailor that to the particular natural landscape that you live in, that like maybe bluebells aren't as relevant to someone in a different part of the world, but that knowing and loving and being curious and wanting to be out in the natural world is something that, even if it isn't a reality, is absolutely something we should be aspiring to. And so to take it out of something like the junior dictionary just almost shows a lack of confidence that we can even expect kids or adults to be interested in these things.
Yeah, and it's also something that we really have to fight for in our own lives,
mm-hmm.
that you have to cultivate it. It won't just come if you sit by and wait for it.
Right, yeah, that it is a capability, like it is something that you have to work on and learn and accrue and take interest in over time.
So
I think maybe that's a good natural stopping point to this discussion. I think we want to go back and read out one particular quote, which is just an iconic quote from Swallows and Amazons, and I don't think we can have a discussion about these books without saying it. So Phoebe, do you want to give the context and then maybe read out the quote?
Will do. So this comes very early on at the beginning of Swallows and Amazons, when the children have written to their father to ask for permission to go and camp on the island, and their mother has also written, and she's received a telegram response that she gives to them, and it says, "Better drowned than duffers. If not, duffers won't drown."
Which, if you don't quite follow or are not familiar with the word duffers, essentially translates to, if they are fools, then they're better off to be drowned, which is obviously an exaggeration and a joke. But he says, if not fools, they won't drown. And so he's saying that, you know, he has the confidence in them, that he believes that they're not duffers, they won't drown, they're going to have a fun time. But it's such a great line, and it's just, yeah, it's fun to say, it's just fun to embody that, yeah. If not, duffers won't drown. And yeah, maybe like to take that into your life and look at the challenges that you're faced with and say, if not, duffers won't drown, and just keep plowing through with a sense of joyful confidence.
Yeah, and they also use that almost as a yardstick of, oh, I was a duffer there.
Yeah, that like, oh, I went too far, we almost drowned.
Yeah.
Like,
we were duffers.
So yeah, I just love that so much. And I think there are more and more people reading Swallows and Amazons. I think it's having a little bit of a resurgence. I know there was a film version of it not that long ago. I don't think we watched it. No. So I will have to see what that is like at some point. But I would really recommend these books. I think they're wonderful.
Yeah, and the later series, they can be, some of them will like be hit and miss, like you might like some more than others.
Mm.
But we've talked about the second a lot. The fourth is wonderful. Mm. And I think it was Pigeon Post is another one that's lovely.
Yeah. So and just in time for some late spring, early summer reading. I think mm-hmm. they make perfect summer reading books. So
they really do.
I would really recommend them. Which just leaves us with our usual final question. Phoebe, what have you been enjoying at the moment?
Well, our friend Jacob was putting on a screening of a Hildegard of Bingen one-off just narrative of her life,
mm-hmm.
which was fascinating and really interesting stylistically. I think it's available on YouTube in very poor quality, but it's a BBC like 1 hour, or was it even 40 minutes adaptation. But yeah, really fun, would recommend.
Very beautiful. Yeah. I found it quite meditative. Hildegard of Bingen is played by Patricia Routledge, which if any of our listeners know UK 90s sitcoms will know her as Hyacinth Bouquet from Keeping Up Appearances. The piece that we watched last night itself was from 1994, so definitely older. But I remember when it finished, I just sort of said, I can't believe they made this. It was so spiritual and
wacky and interesting.
Like embraced the sort of unusual elements and the mystical elements. I thought it was great too. I think for what I've been enjoying, I will give Phoebe a shout out and say that a couple of weeks ago, Phoebe sat down and showed me how to actually knit. I had done a very small amount of knitting in my childhood. I could do just the garter stitch, but I couldn't cast on. I couldn't do the stocking stitch. I couldn't do pretty much anything. And I am now loving it. So I am knitting away and I have to be torn away from it occasionally. So that's what I've been enjoying at the moment. So I think that's pretty much it. Mm-hmm. We want to wish you all a very happy Easter and happy Easter season. And like I said, I hope this episode comes out before Easter, but if not, it will be very shortly into the Easter season. So just wishing everyone a blessed Holy Week and a very happy Easter. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you to everyone who's reached out. As always, it's just so kind. I love getting the comments and the emails in. It's just very, I have such lovely, generous listeners. If you want to get our email whenever a new episode comes out, you can find that on my website, which is rachelsherlock.com. If you just go to the podcast section of that, you can sign up for our email. And as always, you can follow us on various social medias, which I'll link in the description. Thanks again for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
This has been Risking Enchantment. Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter with the handle @SeekingWatson. And you can find out more about me and the podcast at rachelsherlock.com. Thank you and God bless.